Welcome to the session on a report from the General Insurance Risk Appetite Working Party. My name is David Coob, and for my sins, I'm the convener of this group. This working party was started by the General Insurance Practice Committee in early this year or later last year, in response to APRA's CPS 220, which was going to require insurers to change the way they do their risk appetite statements. And looking around the literature, there's very few papers on risk appetite for general insurance companies. There's one done for Gyro in 2012, and one which was prepared in 2012 for the American societies and Canadian societies. And the aim of this paper was to give practical assistance to insurers in risk appetite going forward, particularly in light of CPS 220. We gave a presentation on this topic earlier in May at an insight session, and we talked about the composition of a company's risk appetite framework and how it fit into risk management framework. Since this working party was set up, the Life Insurance and Wealth Management Practice Committee established their own working group, and we've been working with them quite closely with them to make sure that we're covering things well, and many of the sections at the top of the paper will be common. The two papers will be finalised probably early next year, and they will be, after vetting by the two practice committees, and they'll be out in the open then. Today we're covering a few parts of the paper. In particular, I'm going to give a bit of an outline of what's in the paper, and Andy White's going to say what you need to have good practice, and Steve Britt's going to talk about some of the challenges. The other members of the working party include James Basman, Andy Cohen, Ben Cooper, Daryl Ferreira, and Angela Totaro. The paper will is organised like this. First of all, we're going to talk about the risk appetite framework and include definitions of the things which are important, including the risk appetite framework, the risk appetite statement, risk capacity, risk tolerances, risk limits, and risk profile. In looking at the literature, there are lots of ways in which these are defined, and we have looked at the various places where the definitions have been used and defined well, and we've chosen which ones are best, and in some cases chose our own. The Institute of Risk Management had a paper in 2011 which is on risk appetite and tolerance, which was a very useful seminal paper. And in 2013 there were two papers, one by the Financial Stability Board and another by the CRO Forum, which is a forum of the major CROs in North America and Europe. And then we're going to look at what risks insurers are facing, and particularly looking at what the materiality of the various risks. Looking at the risk appetite statement, we're going to consider who the stakeholders are, what are characteristics of a good risk appetite statement, and then think about what sort of things could be included in that statement. And under risk tolerances and limits, we're going to define them, and Steve's going to talk a bit about that later. Because there's a lot of confusion about what is a risk tolerance and what is a risk limit, and in a company and outside companies, and so we're trying to clarify what they really are and what they mean. Now, the risk management, we're going to talk about embedding and cascading, monitoring, reporting, and risk appetite. So that's just a very quick introduction to the paper. I'd like to hand over to Andy White, who is Group Head of Capital Modelling for QBE. He's worked for QBE in the European, Asia Pacific and Australian divisions, and he's been heavily involved in the development of their ICAP and capital and risk models. Over to Andy.
Thank you, David. I was actually expecting you to tell some lies about me there and pick on me, so I'm actually quite pleased you didn't. Cool. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about good practice in risk appetite statements. And as David said, there is a variety of literature out there, and there's quite a few different views from different industries, etc. So one of the things we did was a big literature review, and actually tried to distill what makes a good risk appetite statement down to a few, in fact, seven key principles. So the first principle was that it should be holistic, and it needs to look across all of the material risks that the insurer faces. The second one, and probably one of the most important ones, particularly I know APRA press this point a lot, is it needs to genuinely reflect the board's appetite for risk and be expressed in terms that the board actually care about, because it needs to be board-owned. The third one, and this is one that I'm quite passionate about, is that it needs to be forward-looking. So you should have exposures talked about in there rather than outcomes. So, for example, if you think about your investment portfolio, now an outcome-based risk appetite statement might say we're not to lose more than 5% of funds under management in any given week. So let's say your investment manager has gone on leave, he goes away for the week, and all the stock markets crash, and you lose 6% of funds under management. Are you outside of appetite? To be honest, you've breached a statement. You'd suggest the answer should be yes. Okay, so this guy's done nothing, he's been on leave for the week. Before he went, let's say the markets hadn't tanked and actually they'd done fine and you've made a couple of percent. Were you outside of risk appetite? My answer would be yes. Your exposure is exactly the same in both cases. If you were exposed to the chance of breaching, you know, losing more than a certain amount, it was the same in both cases. So that's why I don't think outcome-based statements are necessarily right, and it should actually be forward-looking exposure-based statements. Internally consistent is the fourth of the principles we came up with. And this is really important. I mean, if you think about it, let's say you're at a high level, you say we should have no more than a 1 in 10 chance of making a profit, or sorry, a loss after tax. But then if your underwriting risk statements are much more aggressive than that, then clearly the two don't match up. So you're lacking that internal consistency between the statements. Likewise, between market risk and underwriting risk, it would seem silly to take lots and lots of risk in one category where there's actually a better risk-reward trade-off in the other one, and you're taking virtually none. So that consistency across the whole risk appetite statement and across your whole risk management framework is really important. Number five is tight wording, and that's really important. I mean, if you think about when you're doing performance reviews for your staff and you're setting objectives for the year, typically I know the acronym we use is SMART, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic and timely. You really need to set SMART risk appetite statements. So you don't want to make them too waffly, and you actually want to reduce the ambiguity of when people are looking at these and actually trying to implement them in the business, and you also want to make them measurable. And finally, and probably the most important two actually, cascadable and usable. So you really need your risk appetite to be embedded into the risk culture of the organisation, and that's another bit of a buzzword in the risk management circles at the moment, and certainly regulators are quite keen on risk culture, and the two should be tied up quite nicely. And the real proof of the pudding is in the eating. So it's when the risk appetite statement actually guides people's actions and people actually do things based on the risk appetite statement. So when we were thinking of risk appetite statements, we really thought about it in three tiers, if you like. So the top tier is in terms of things that the board care about. So these are things like achievement of target performance, preservation of capital, and protection of your franchise value. And these are holistic statements across the organisation. The second tier, which need to be consistent with them and hang off them, are things that are more at a risk type level. And these are things that are likely to be more of interest to executive management. So your chief underwriting officer knows the extent of underwriting risk that you're able to take. Now, the first two of these probably belong in your risk appetite statement, and typically they will. However, when it comes to operationalising this and turning this into the so what for the people at the front line, it's really the tier three that becomes important. It's that cascading piece. So your level one underwriters may not have read your risk appetite statement, and to be honest, they don't really need to. But what is important is that they know what policies they have to adhere to, what procedures they have to follow, what the limits of their delegated authorities are. And if these are well designed, those bits and pieces actually really embed tier one and tier two and the whole risk appetite statement into the organisation. The other important thing in terms of operationalising and cascading is use. So both in terms of actually measuring your risk profile against your risk appetite, and also then what actions you take if you do get outside of appetite, but also then other uses of your risk appetite statement. So there's actually a session this afternoon on capitalising on risk, and ICAP certainly falls into that area. So when you're setting your capital targets in your ICAP, your risk appetite should obviously be a prominent feature of that. You might also use it to look at your underwriting strategy and plan. You might use it for looking, or you should use it for looking at your reinsurance structures. So if you're looking at different reinsurance structures, which ones actually match your risk appetite better? Okay, so in terms of actually articulating and expressing risk appetite, we categorised most risk appetite expressions into one of seven categories. Now, the one where actuaries typically play the most, and arguably where we can add the most value, is in the probabilistic statements. Now, different stakeholders will be interested in different points of the curve. So, for example, your CEO might be more interested in profit and loss variability. Your policyholders and bondholders might be more interested in the point of the curve where you actually are unable to pay them out. So a risk appetite statement needs to consider a range of different metrics. There are drawbacks, though, to probabilistic statements, particularly that you actually do need to have robust models to be able to use them, and that obviously opens you up to model risk as well. The other issue is they might be a bit of a black box, so when it comes to the business actually looking at those, they may not feel as much connection to them because it is a bit of a black box that a team of analysts pump out. So there are a number of other different types of expressions that you might want to use. Now, we talked a little bit before about the outcome-based statements and the fact that they're not ideal, but they can be used to supplement other statements in there. However, it does fail. I mean, one of the characteristics on the front there, it certainly does fail that. So another one you might want to use is exposure-based metrics. So, for example, these may be based on a scenario. So it may be, going back to the funds under management approach, we don't want to lose more than X percent of funds under management under the following scenarios. Now, that ticks more of the boxes on the previous slide than the outcome-based statement would. There's also qualitative statements, so behavioural and cultural type of statements, and these are really to set expectations of your employees, so they're aligned to the overall risk appetite statement. The challenge here is actually making them sufficiently tightly worded so there's not a broad range of interpretation and that people are actually aligned by those. You also have risk level statements, which are very hard to make tight. That is to say, for example, we have a low appetite for market risk, but that would be very open to interpretation and quite hard to actually operationalise. And the one I find actually quite interesting is a delegated one. So I remember seeing this on a risk appetite statement and thinking, well, hang on a minute, how can S&P A plus, actually that's a target and not a risk appetite metric. But actually thinking about it, what management are saying is we want S&P or whoever the rating agency may be to rate our risk profile and our capital position to be sufficiently strong to achieve an A plus rating. So actually it's a very good statement to have in your risk appetite because you're not just purely relying on internal metrics and your internal staff telling you what your risk position is. So as a board member, I'd actually want that in there. Now, the other challenge is how to define your risk appetite. So, you know, you need to elicit from the board what their risk appetite is. And one way of doing that is an approach called choice attribution. So what you can potentially go to the board with is a whole range of scenarios and questions and situations and say, OK, here's two reinsurance contracts. One protects you more at the 1 in 5 to 1 in 10 year return period, but obviously at that level it's going to be a little bit more expensive, so your average profit after tax will be a little bit lower. The second structure protects you more at the top end, but you have more P&L variability. Which of those two do you prefer? Now, through a structured process, and I've just made that one up, but you'd have people much smarter than me coming up with a much more structured process, and that can actually be used to elicit the risk appetite of the board and tailor the risk appetite statement. So, what I would like to do is play a little game just to pull this a little bit together. That microphone's working. Good. Okay, so hopefully everyone has heard of the game Russian Roulette, where you put a bullet in the chamber of a revolver, spin the chamber and hold it to your head and pull the trigger. And assuming you haven't blown your brains out, you pass the gun on to the next person. Okay, there's no live ammo here. What we are going to do is play a little game. So the game is, there's $1 billion on offer. Imagine a gun can be infinitely large, so you can have as many chambers in that revolver as you want. The question is, what is the lowest number of chambers in that gun you would play Russian roulette with to win $1 billion? And what we're going to do is a reverse auction. So we're going to start with a very high number, and we're going to gradually go lower and lower until we're left with just one person. and we'll see who has the highest risk appetite. Okay. So for $1 billion, who would play this game with a billion chambered revolver? That's most people, and I have to admit, so would I. Okay. 100 million. Still have most hands up. 10 million. Still got a good 10 people there. 1 million. Still have half a dozen. 100,000. Got a bidding war going on. 10,000. We're down to 3, I think, there. 1,000. Ooh, we've got 2 left in. 500. 100. Ooh, man, this is tight. 50. We have a winner. 1 in 50. Round of applause. Your prize is being the most risk-taking person in the room. Well done. I'm afraid I don't have $1 billion to give. But it's an interesting game to play. I've done this with quite a few different people. And a lot of people just said, no, I'm just not doing it. Full stop. I'm not risking blowing my brains out. Or, you know, a lot of people will stop at 1 in 1 billion or 1 in 100 million. So I looked at some stats from an article in The Economist last year. The chance of being killed, according to The Economist, in the US by a meteor strike is 1 in 75 million in any given year. So, to be honest, you should probably be picking a number lower than that. Being killed by lightning is in the ballpark of 1 in 10 million. Being killed while cycling is 1 in 350,000. Now, I cycle to work, and if I had $1 billion, I wouldn't be coming to work. So I should be picking a number lower than 1 in 350,000. And if you actually go down, the risk of dying from heart disease in any given year is less than 1 in 1,000. Now, I don't know about you guys, but most of us have fairly stressful jobs. If you didn't have to work, your stress levels would be lower. Your chance of having a heart attack would probably drop. So to be honest, a number of 1 in 10,000 is not a ridiculous number at all. And in fact, most people, if you look at the other decisions you take in your life, you're probably be picking a number lower than that. So it's just interesting to think about that consistency piece between the risk appetite areas of the risk appetite statement. You're willing to cross a road with X percent chance of being killed or cycle to work, but you're not willing to play out a game, which has a much bigger reward and a much lower risk. So it might be worth people actually thinking about writing their own personal risk appetite statements and applying the principles we had on the screen a little while ago.
Just in case.
And with that, I will hand over to, actually back to David to introduce Stephen.
Steve Britt's going to talk about challenges. He is a senior manager in economic capital at IAG and has been there since 2004. He is an actuary and a CFA charter holder who spent most of his working life advising on the interactions between asset and liability side of the balance sheets.
Thank you, David. First risk I'll make sure I don't incur is risk of going over, so I'm going to have a look at the clock there.
Did anybody feel like they wouldn't play this game for 1 in 1 million, but might actually play the game for 1 in 10,000? Because if you ask lots of people, they will actually might do that, because a billion is an unknown number, so they don't focus on the number, they focus on the bullet. Whereas once you get down to 10,000, it becomes meaningful, and they can actually think about it, and they can think through the questions and the chances and so forth. And that brings me to the first. I'm going to talk about the challenges, and the first of the challenges that I'm going to raise is that you can ask somebody to express a level of risk appetite, and their answer will depend on their risk aversion, whether you ask it in warm weather or cold weather, whether they're keen to go to the loo, whether you use transitive verbs, whether it's an active statement or a passive statement. So you will get different answers depending on how you actually ask the question. And furthermore, if you ask them the next day, they will probably give you a different answer because you phrased it slightly differently. And this idea that people can't actually articulate levels of risk aversion consistently or coherently was raised in a paper that all actuaries should, well, read some of their later stuff on prospect theory by Kahneman and Tversky in 1979. What they did coming out of pure microeconomic literature is the sort of questions that were asked previously, like, do you prefer to buy 100 million, excess 100 million cost of cover, or keep the premium of 30 mil? So that's a level of risk appetite. And but depending on how you ask the question, you will get different answers. Here's an interesting one. Would you prefer to buy a health insurance product that protects you for any risks or any disease? Most people will pay more for an insurance policy that protects against any disease rather than an insurance policy that protects against any risk, because disease is a horrible thing and it goes to the brain and says, I want protection against that. Any risk is, well, what is a risk? I don't know, and I'm lazy. I'm not going to work out what it means. So prospect theory is, it basically means that if you engage in the conversation with individuals to assess this, you're not going to get a consistent answer. Another one coming from the reverse auction, people aren't transitive in their expression of risk. So just bear with me for a moment. I may prefer outcome B to outcome A. I may prefer outcome C to outcome B, but I may prefer outcome A to outcome C. So I'm basically inconsistent. And when you ask, well, university students is what who are normally asked these things, but they're betting with real money to them. They're inconsistent with their expression of risk appetite, and there's pretty much nothing that they can do about it. That's the way that it works. So first challenge against prospect theory tells you that in theory you can't actually get at what you're trying to, you can't get a board to coherently express their levels of risk against different risks. So they can't express a risk against market risk versus insurance risk. Can you do something about it? Maybe. Not too much. Some of the factors that make it difficult for people to do that is that they're basically lazy. And so what you've got to do with people to try and encourage consistent approaches to risk is to get them thinking using the thinking part of the brain rather than the lazy part of the brain towards the back. Prospect theory. So that's the first reason this stuff is really hard, because in theory it can't be done. Second challenge that I find this one very interesting. We're being asked to express a consideration of risk in a vacuum. We're not being asked to express almost within a vacuum. We're not being asked to assess a risk-reward trade-off. We're not told that we have $1 billion at play. All we're doing is being told that there's the gun and there's the one chamber in it. And without that consideration of risk all the time, you can't really do that risk-return trade-off. So if you look on the left-hand side, that's a straight efficient frontier from finance theory. In a general insurance context, you can think about it as you move your first attachment point to your cap tower higher and higher and higher, you see less and less insurance profit, but you're taking on more volatility in that in the underlying earnings. You can assess, maybe, the trade-off between the premium and the amount of volatility of insurance margin you're after there. That's fine, but in a risk appetite statement, the problem is that we're being asked to say how much risk are we willing to bear in the pursuit of our objectives. Now, that risk is changing all the time. And so by expressing an absolute limit to it, you should probably, if you were rational, set this limit to the right of where where you would naturally prefer the risk-return trade-off to be. So you should actually be expressing risk limits and risk appetites as more aggressive than you actually feel at any point in time. Then you delegate to the people who are implementing, and they will go down the risk scale. Now, those are the two main... Well, those are the two interesting challenges that I have. On a more prosaic matter, I think the first challenge in implementation is to actually link the risk appetite discussion with the objectives and strategies discussion and get them happening simultaneously, because that's the only way you can get somebody to consider the reward that you're hoping to achieve in the pursuit of the risk consistently. You may be able to get some high-level risk-return trade-offs there. Once you've actually had that conversation and once you've actually managed to get the board thinking about the risk and reward simultaneously and coherently, if you can, you then need to cascade that down into broad appetite statements or broad operational limits. Now, in a lot of this stuff comes originated in investment banks in the 90s, early 2000s, and they had the advantage there that they were all talking about money. They were generally talking about trading positions. They could all talk about VAR, so they could all have the conversation about the limits or the willingness to bear risk in the same framework of a value at risk type of statement. They don't necessarily aggregate up, but at least everybody was on the same page. Talk to an underwriter about the VAR on the book that you're allowing them to run, and you shouldn't be allowed to have that conversation twice, because it's a meaningless comment to them in the first place. And why try to impose a language on an underwriter? Why not talk to the underwriter in the language of underwriting? But that means that you have a different conversation when you're talking to your chief investment officer to when you're talking to your underwriter, when you're talking to your domestic lines underwriters, to your reinsurance purchaser. And since you're having conversations in different ways and expressing your limits and your risk appetite in different ways, that makes it harder to aggregate it up to make sure that you're meeting the total risk appetite for the volatility of earnings. The last one, and the clock stopped, so I'm not sure. Okay, 2 minutes. When you're reading this stuff, what you find every time you read a paper on this, they're going to define everything because whoever wrote the paper previously defined it differently to the person who wrote the third paper. So you've got a tolerance means absolutely everything in somebody's paper. So every time you write a paper, you've got, or every time you have the conversation, you need to define your terms so that people can try to be on the same page. And this is really tricky. When you look at our paper, you'll see that we've gone to a lot of effort to define. Well, we tried to get the biggest boss we could find, which is the Financial Stability Board, and we use their definitions as much as possible. But there are two points here. One is an expression of a willingness to bear risk, which we're calling a tolerance, and the actions that are taken to implement that willingness to bear risk. And they are two different things. One is something that a board can and should express. We don't really want to lose more than $100 million from a single cat event, which is not the same as saying you've got to buy cat cover up to $100 million, because there are multiple ways you can reduce that. You could co-insure, you can buy cat cover, you can change your exposures, and I'd suggest that management are better able to think about the limits that should be imposed after a board has said what risk that they're willing to bear. So we've had an overview of the paper. We've had a reverse auction. Sarah's lost, I think. I think she lost. She may have won. I'll be very curious as to what your kids think about your decision, Sarah. And we've spoken about some of the theoretical difficulties here and some of the practical implications. With that, we're going to stop and take any questions. So please. And otherwise, I'll have to tell a joke, and you really don't want that.
Tom Karp, ex-regulator from a few years now, but now a board director on a terrorism insurer. So we have interesting discussions about risk appetite. But firstly, from a regulator's perspective, all of this stuff's all very good, but when you actually try and put it into practice, it's obviously very difficult. But one of the tests that I used to think of was that if an organisation is thinking about making a major acquisition, can they assess that against their risk appetite statement? If they can't, then the appetite statement isn't any good, because major acquisitions are obviously what kills a lot of companies. Second comment is that the other thing that kills a lot of companies is dominant CEOs, and then you start to get into the whole governance strategic risk area, which is a bit harder to make an appetite statement about. I might just leave that one there, but I'd be interested in any comments about how you think what you're coming up with will deal with the first comment I made.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when we talked about use, I totally agree with you. I think the proof is when you actually start using things. And acquisition is a perfect example. Reinsurance purchasing is another. You want to be able to point to examples of, we assessed these things against our risk appetite. So I agree. I mean, if it's a well-worded risk appetite statement, it is holistic. And it meets all of those criteria we've met. And then you actually use it. First of all, meeting all of those will make it usable, and secondly, then the proof is in the actual using of it. So I totally agree with you.
You're a regulator, so I'll take the alternate view. I don't think you can assess whether something is within a risk appetite without considering the reward that you get from it. So I'm firmly on the slope of the, well, I'm a finance guy, so I understand the left-hand side chart more than the other one. But I think that you need to, you need to assess the reward of an acquisition, and if the potential is there, you would, you should have a greater appetite for a lucrative acquisition than one which is just so average. It's interesting on the other point on the dominant CEO says there's been a number of papers by Standard & Poor's, the General Insurance Working Party, on insurance company failures, and mostly it's either incompetent management or ratbag management. So if you can control that, which is why the director's test is probably so important. Thank you for the question. One from the right-hand side of the... from our right, please.
There is a considerable difference between risk and perceived risk, and we were having this conversation with a client once, and they were really worried about their operational risk exposure, but they were really worried about a plane crashing into the building versus how many people on average would trip over wires and cause a claim. What can companies do to really put things into perspective and fix that?
Numbers.
Yep. Well, that certainly goes back to that point as well we made before about you need to focus on what's actually important. So it very much plays back to the reverse auction. You're willing to, you know, take massive risks here for very little reward, but then you're not willing to take a $1 in a billion. Certainly, I think that's where modelling can be useful, and certainly one of the approaches we've piloted internally is actually using our economic capital model to drive our risk assessments, to try and put things into perspective a little. So when you're looking at, for example, some of the op-risk subcategories, if you look at, use the 7-bar op-risk subcategories, what's the potential impact of that on us at a particular return period? Compare that to what's the impact of cat risk or reserve risk at the same return period. And it really kind of puts that into perspective quite well. So I think scenario analysis is one area that could be useful. To say, well, you know, worst case scenario, plane crash into the building. But what is, you know, with some kind of analysis, what's the likelihood of that happening realistically? What would it do to us? Versus how many people, you probably would have data on how many people are actually injured in OH&S incidents within the office in any given year. So I think the more you can put either data behind it or some kind of analysis or scenario analysis, that certainly helps bring that to life a little bit more for people.
Perceived risk versus actual risk. What happens when you bring up that image of the plane going into the World Trade Center is... you think about it, and as a part of the brain just releases stress chemicals into your bloodstream and into your brain, and everything is saying, do I fight or do I flight? And you can't do either. But while those chemicals, and I forget their name, are coursing through your body, your brain is saying, don't think about it, do something. And so to get the perceived risk as opposed to the actual, to get the conversation going about the active risk, you need to actually get the fight or flight response off the table and bring the rational in. And one of the proposals that I've read is have the conversation, and somebody's got to guide it, somebody's got to guide the conversation, and they've got to engage the thinking part of the brain. So you've got to start somebody, move a little bit, then everybody has to think about how did she get from that to that statement that she made. Once they're actually thinking about things rationally, you are actually using the correct side of the brain to make a rational risk return assessment. That there are books on this stuff and the coping mechanisms. So that's it.
We're getting a strong hint we need to close. Thanks everyone for coming, and thank Steve and Andy for their contributions.